Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 24th of April. Coming up on the program, devastating floods in Mauritius. It is a new haven for many South Africans. I'll talk to a reporter in the capital, Port Louis. How the El Nino effect is impacting the South African and regional economy. There's a new campaign to combat book piracy. Why we spin wheels when it comes to white-collar crime prosecution and the risks around the two-pot retirement system. Devastating floods that struck Mauritius have left a trail of destruction and a hefty price tag. While a complete picture is still emerging, initial estimates suggest the economic impact is going to be significant. Why is this important for us? Well, major South African brands in Mauritius include Woolworths, Food Lovers, Spur, Nando's and Ocean Basket. So let me give you an update. I'm joined now by Jean-Luc Emile. He is a journalist based in the capital. Jean-Luc, welcome. And first of all, can you describe the overall scale of the damage?
Well, the most striking image we can say about Sunday's extreme weather event in Mauritius was again in Port Louis area. It was in the heart of Port Louis at Trong Bar in the capital city, and the Ramsahai family faced this unimaginable ordeal. Amid the torrential rains that was in this region, the two-story home succumbed to the deluge. And this was the only image which every Mauritian people retained from this event of Sunday. It was on the headlines of every newspaper. What we can say is these floods have left a trail of destruction with significant economic and social impacts here. On Monday, many businesses were forced to close for a day, causing an estimated loss of 1.5 billion rupees to the economy. This highlights the island's dependence on a functioning business sector and the disruption caused by such extreme weather events. What we can say about the people's livelihoods affected here in Mauritius on Sunday, over 735 persons have applied for government assistance after their food supplies were damaged by the floods, and the government is providing a one-time 250 rupees aid per person. This has started today. They are actually collecting their allocation at the municipality council. What we can say also is the flood caused significant damage to the infrastructure, and repairs and improvements will require substantial investment.
Now, the projected costs then and timeline, Jean-Luc, for these infrastructure repairs post-flood, that's going to not only be expensive, but it's also going to take some time, I imagine.
Yeah, it will take a long time because what has been said yet by the authorities yesterday in the parliament, there has been a private notice question put to the Minister of Public Infrastructure about this flooding and what will be the way forward. And he said that the main limitation, the main constraint of the Mauritian government is the time the contractor to whom we award the contracts for the construction of drain. It took time. There is a compulsory acquisition of land to have bigger drain to overcome these kind of difficulties. This takes time, but also the construction takes time. We put the question yesterday to one representative of the government to know in those regions which have been affected on Sunday, if quickly those work would be done. He said they don't have any time lapse for that, but they would be happy to start it very soon in prevention of the coming rainy season. But they can't give any guarantee that it would start very quickly because it all depends on the contractors' working pace and how the work would be going around the country.
And Jean-Luc, many South Africans have business interests in Mauritius. I'm assuming the transport services, roads, flights were affected by the flooding, what measures are being taken to restore them?
Yeah, you rightly said, because, you know, business owners in Mauritius are worried about the lack of security for their assets due to the frequent flooding. They feel their investments are at risk with no guarantee of return. And for what we have seen on Sunday, it's not a working day in Mauritius. We have seen that the metro was not working. The bus also stopped the circulation because of the quantity of volume of water on the roads. And this is a big issue, because when it rains in Mauritius, you have the traffic jam in Port Louis. It's a real curse for those traveling or working in Port Louis. And this can be a great disadvantage for those having their business in this region. I think business owners, they are worried, yes, but the authorities are trying to look forward how to help those persons. But some engineers and scientific proposing now the relocating the capital city of Port Louis due to its vulnerability to climate change, while a costly undertaking, you said, it could be a long-term investment for the nation's future.
Jean-Luc Amil, thank you very much for talking to me. All right, I want to stay with a weather theme, and there is new research that shows the impact of the El Niño Southern Oscillation climatic phenomenon has confirmed that the 23-24 El Niño was among the top five strongest on record. So what impact then is this having on the economy, on food security? Joining us now is Dr. Blessing Masamba, research specialist at the Human Sciences Research Council. Doctor, very warm welcome to you. So how has the strength of this compared to previous such events, and what is the impact likely to be?
Thank you, Jeremy. I think you are all aware of what is happening in about 8 countries in the Southern African region because of the El Nino phenomenon, and it is characterized by extreme high temperatures, and it has also had dry spells for more than 30 days, something that has not happened in Southern Africa since 1981, close to more than 40 years. So this has actually led to crop failure in most countries, particularly Zimbabwe, Zambia, Mozambique. They were hard hit by this dry spell and complete crop failure, which is leading to poor harvests. And it means for most crops like maize, wheat, there's going to be a critical shortage of that crop, and extreme water shortage. The reservoirs will run dry, and it will affect livestock as well as in the long term as the year progresses. So there's going to be poor food security, extreme food insecurity, and malnutrition among households which rely mainly on rain-fed agriculture within this region.
And this will affect tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. How would you rate the region's preparedness then in that respect?
As it stands, as a region, we are not prepared for this. Judging by the immediate need in terms of food insecure households, rather, we talk in terms of how we should have built resilience amongst our farmers, who constitute mainly of smaller farmers in rural areas and parts, also emerging farmers in urban and peri-urban communities. So we are not really prepared up to date as a region. Of course, we have several countries, one or two, who are doing well in terms of irrigation, technology, and so forth. But we can safely say we are not prepared as a region to deal with this, because we were supposed to have predicted this much earlier with a properly set or established early warning system that could have predicted this scenario and have made plans to actually safeguard or to make coping mechanisms that would include water harvesting, irrigation systems, and a number of coping mechanisms that would build resilience and not affect make the magnitude with which it is affecting the most of these countries. So we are not prepared, and we have mechanisms that we need to put in place now going forward, because this is recurring. 2 to 5 years, the intensity and the recurrence of this El Niño phenomenon is increasingly becoming more and more frequent in the region. So we need to be prepared as we go forward.
What would have prevented countries from implementing an early warning system?
That's a very good question, Jeremy. What we are experiencing as a region here is, well, From the Human Sciences Research Council, we rolled out a study, multi-country study in Zambia, and we concluded in Zambia and Tanzania, looking at climate smart agriculture technologies and how the communities are faring and adopting these. So you can see that we are not having enough technology at stake that is actually being driven by policy. So it starts from the policy level, regional policy level. We don't have the coordinated approach that can actually drive the pooling of resources and expertise to actually implement those, because they need resources, irrigation equipment, even low-level irrigation equipment, water harvesting reservoir, water reservoirs. They need technology and pooling of resources to have water bodies that can store water. But also, because of the policy incoherence at the national levels as well, they are very limited. We cannot say no, but efforts are being made. We appreciate in the respective countries, but the policy framework and the implementation does not have the tracking mechanisms to look at, based on empirical evidence, to drive the coping mechanisms that are required to deal with this phenomenon. So we need a properly installed and efficient early warning system that becomes regional, and also country-specific technologies that have early warning systems for specific regions that are affected. So we need, as a region and as respective country, member countries in Southern Africa, to invest in the policy formulation, implementation and tracking, monitoring and evaluation on how it's working and the technologies themselves.
Dr. Masamba, just very quickly in conclusion, what immediate steps need to be taken, though, in order to alleviate what you've outlined as a humanitarian crisis?
We definitely need immediate, what I may term, maybe categorize into short-term and medium to long-term coping mechanisms at the moment. In countries where there's immediate need of food aid or humanitarian food aid, we need to upscale. Already there are some initiatives that are there, but the magnitude of the crisis requires an upscaling of humanitarian aid in terms of food. And also we need some policy restructuring in terms of importation of food. So we would need actually the countries in the region to loosen up their import restrictions and specific foods, but of course not actually doing away with the protocols that guard against transmission of diseases and so forth. And also we need, for countries like South Africa and Tanzania, who have relatively a surplus and they have not been adversely affected to the extent as these other countries, they need to limit their stocks of maize particularly that they have. They may not need to satisfy the other international markets like the Asian markets and the European markets or South American markets, and focus more on the regional supply, because we have South Africa and Zambia, we have been having surplus. So if they focus more on the regional supplies to Zimbabwe, Malawi, Mozambique, Zambia, Botswana, the West affected region, it will actually help for the food and or social protection also. We need some cash transfers. Most of these countries, they do not save for South Africa. They don't have social protection initiatives to actually provide immediate possible income to deal with accessing food and buying from markets as well. So those initiatives are part of the process.
Dr. Blessing Masamba, thank you very much indeed. And a stark warning certainly has been sounded in that respect. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
My next guest writes that over the past few weeks or so, South Africa's law enforcement instruments have come under renewed scrutiny as glaring gaps between offences and consequences remain prevalent for high-profile cases. Writer, activist and accountant Kaya Setole says there are glaring gaps between offences and consequences, particularly when it comes to white-collar crime. He joins us now on the programme. And Kaya, first of all then, the gaps that you talk about, can you elaborate on those?
So I think the problem with regulations and law enforcement is that one must regulate for an industry at large rather than the exceptions and the outliers. In other words, when you look at some of the sanctions and the, you know, the punishment that can be delivered in relation to particular offenses, it tends to cater for what the market dynamics at large are. But of course, within every single market, there will always be outliers and there'll be exceptions. And I think obviously the example that we tend to use is the Steinhoff example, where if you look at the scale of the harm that was caused by the fraud that was perpetuated there, basically no number will ever be good enough. But then that leads to this instinctive reaction to say, well, if the answer is that a 15 million rand fine, for example, is the maximum amount payable, and yet billions of rands were lost, then there seems to be a disconnect between the scale on the of the harm versus the potential sanctions. You've also seen it in relation to the regulation of the auditing profession for a very long time, when the maximum penalties that were available to be delivered on errant and deviant auditors were capped at a number that was simply too small in relation to some of the big social harm that was caused there. But of course, what then happens is that there's then this instinctive reaction to then say, well, the fines need to be as punitive as possible. But regulators have the responsibility to keep reminding us that, yes, there might be outliers once in a while, but it's very unlikely that you're going to have 10 or 20 or even 50 cases where the harm runs into the type of billions that then warrants us having a punishment regime that says whenever something of this nature happens, then the fine should be 2 or 3 or 10 billion. That's the first problem. The second and perhaps more difficult problem is a simple question of who actually bears the burden for actually honoring these penalties. It is very clear that over the many years that we've seen the corporate scandals, those that perpetrate the scandals tend to exit. Usually they get fired or they disappear, or in some instances they commit suicide. So when we then get to the question of, well, here is the scale of the harm, these are the penalties that actually need to be paid, then the question is, well, who's paying? And in the instance where those that have perpetrated the crime have either been incarcerated or have left the company, then it actually comes back as a double whammy to the shareholders and the other stakeholders of the company, who now have to pay for a crime that in some instances they may not even have been aware that it was indeed committed. And we saw that problem with Steinhoff in particular, where a fine of a particular number gets reduced by a tribunal on the basis that, well, actually, who are you punishing here? Because the people that are still trying to oversee this company in the aftermath of the disaster are the ones that are trying to correct it. And any extractive penalty will simply punish those that are actually the innocent bystanders, in other words, the shareholders and the various stakeholders. So that's where the complexities emanate from.
It's not only a complex problem, but it's also a bleak problem that you outline as well, which then leads me to ask this question. Obviously, systemic changes are necessary to ensure that penalties are timely, but perhaps more importantly, Kaya, commensurate with the crimes that have been committed. What needs changing?
So what we've seen in other models is that it's a model that allows for flexibility in relation to the nature of the sanctions and the method in which the sanctions can be applied. So the difference there is that when you have a fixed penalty regime, it then does create this artificial cap that even in instances where the regulators and society and everyone agrees that, well, actually, we need much more to actually illustrate that this should not be done ever again, then if you're bound by that statutory cap, then you essentially end up with a number that everybody would think is a rather meaningless penalty in relation to the crimes that have been committed. But what happens with the more flexible regime is the one that is probably based on what you may call a sliding scale. So if it's said, for example, that if the nature of the crime meets these particular dimensions, then the amount to be levied is based on either turnover or based on profits that are generated during that particular period, then you get to see that perhaps there's a much closer alignment between what we're trying to address and obviously what the financial windfall will be. The Competition Commission does quite a good job of applying that rather flexible regime, where obviously if something is turnover based, those that exploited the loopholes or the system well enough during that time before they were discovered, they would end up paying more because obviously they should have generated more profits or at least more extraordinary profits than otherwise would have been allowed had they not broken the rules.
You also allude to the fact that we have the perception in this country, and it's probably not a perception, it's more of a reality, having heard what you've just told me, that white-collar crime is relatively easy. We have a climate almost of impunity. This has an impact on the perception of the public's trust in the judicial system. Do you think we in any way can restore that, or do you think we've tipped over the edge?
I think it will take a very long time to restore it. And part of the problem is the question of capacity and capabilities within law enforcement. The very first rule that we know is that when it comes to the type of shenanigans and corporate crimes that we see, those that will seek to perpetrate are always 10 or 15 steps ahead of the regulators and the regulatory authorities that actually have to then deal with the conduct. So the problem that will always emerge is whether the regulators or the regulatory regime is responsive enough to identify new and emerging trends of what things are, what people are doing out there, and then to put together sufficient mechanisms to counter those. And unfortunately, for as long as regulators and regulations lag behind, there will always be a lead time or some runway that the potential criminals and the perpetrators of the fraud will abuse until somebody understands the nature of the issues well enough to be able to then firstly initiate a process of consultation with all affected stakeholders, and then eventually usher that in into a law amendment if that is what is required. And the history of recent times indicates to us that that's a very long and it's a very complex process on its own. So you do actually give these guys a lot of breathing space while we're trying to get the bureaucratic and the legal mechanisms just in place to respond to the issues that have been identified. But as soon as you put that into law, they discover a new and more sophisticated way of staying ahead of the curve.
Kaya Sitoli, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I want to move on to fraud of a different type now, and the Publishers Association of South Africa has launched an anti-piracy campaign to draw attention to the impact of illegally downloading, sharing and using pirated material. Brian Wafa-Warowa is the Chief Executive Officer of Juta in South Africa and joins me on the program. First of all, how important is it in getting the public on board with this program? And also, how significant is the current spike in piracy?
It has reached the critical level, Jeremy, because the background to this is that for a very long time, we've always had levels of piracy, but they were manageable because it was a few students, a few platforms here and there. But since the NSFAS decision to hand over money that was meant for textbooks and was issued as book tokens before, what the students reverted to then was to actually utilize the money that was meant for textbooks for other wants and needs and delights. And then after doing that, they would still use textbooks, but instead of buying them, they would just rip them and copy them illegally and distribute them among themselves illegally. So it has changed the scenario to a situation where if a book was prescribed for about 100 students, you could sell to 60 students, to a point where the sell-through now is less than 20%, which means less than 20 out of 100 students are buying books. So that's critical.
And Brian, I imagine that better technology makes it easier to reproduce the books.
That's correct. And it also makes it much more difficult to compete with that option, because better technologies, at the press of a button, they download that, and at the press of the button, they send to as many of their colleagues as possible, or they sell as many as possible that way. When we were dealing with photocopying on Xerox machines and others, there was the cost input of ink, paper, and the machine, which means publishers could still compete with that. But today, really, it's competing against zero cost, which makes it very difficult for publishers, but much easier for those that want to violate copyright.
So before we talk about the anti-piracy campaign, what are the long-term consequences of this piracy, both on the quality of education in South Africa and companies such as yours and the provision of learning material?
Yeah, Jeremy, I'm speaking also on behalf of the Publishers Association.
Yes.
Representing about 200 companies. I am the current chair. I think the implications, some of them have already been felt. Some of you may have come across the closure of Adams and Adams, which was a bookshop that was more than 100 years old. The second largest, which is Portia Books, are also closed down. Companies have had to downsize significantly, and that's what we are dealing with now. I think the long-term consequences are quite serious, in the sense that on one side, it's becoming a lot more difficult to go to an author after publishing the first edition and say, let's work on the second edition to update the information or improve the learning approach with the textbook. And the author would understandably say, why would I do that when there was absolutely no return on my earlier effort on the first edition? So we are finding it more difficult to get authors to begin to do that. Some of the companies are also opting out, which basically means at a time when the world is investing in new education technologies, we are seeing an industry that is retreating. So that is quite difficult. I think there was research that was done around the COVID years that there was a correlation between the NS First policy decision, the reduction in the usage of textbooks among students, and the education outcomes among those students. So I think there are long-term consequences. I must also add that whilst it sounds like education is actually the bedrock of the publishing sector in the sense that at 60%, it carries and subsidizes other activities, including general trade publishing. And if you look at a bookshop like Protea, they were not only distributing education books, but also general books which helped the community with literacy development and other things. And when they disappear because of that development in education, the other services that they were offering also develop. So there are significant consequences for society at large and education in particular.
And Brian, just very quickly and in conclusion, what are you hoping to achieve then from this anti-piracy campaign?
We are beginning to see some results out of it. Part of it was we are taking it that there isn't enough appreciation of the consequences, and therefore an education drive will help both lecturers and students. But what we are hoping for, which we are already receiving from universities like UNISA, is that there will be universities coming together with us and saying, how do we discourage students from copying, but at the same time, how do we create alternative and more affordable access to textbooks for students, like licensing and the making of PECs through a licensing group like Dauro? So it's both an awareness and a stemming out of illegal copying.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The upcoming two-pot retirement system should provide, in theory, much-needed relief for cash-strapped South Africans. But today, warnings are being sounded about being judicious with withdrawal and how much money you decide to use. With me now is Professor Adrian Saville. He's a strategist and economist at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Adrian, welcome. And what specific risks, in your opinion, then, does the system pose?
One of the things that it does is it's going to take away capital wealth from your future self. And I think, you know, that aspect, if anything, is underappreciated, because the single most important thing you've got in investing is time. And if you tip anything out of a bucket early, it just, compounding is gone. And by giving people access to this, you know, we have to step away just for a moment from the financial fragility and the strain on a household balance sheets, and recognize that the purpose of a retirement system, the purpose of a pension fund system, is to look after your future self. That's the philosophical point of departure. And by giving people access to retirement assets, you know, early or along the way, you're permanently removing the capacity to look after your future self. So at a philosophical level, you know, there's a real problem with the way that this is designed. Then we have to read it against the backdrop of South Africa's circumstances.
Well, let's talk about South Africa's circumstances. Given our indebtedness as consumers, do you imagine that there is going to be a rush to liquidate, to withdraw?
So I think there will be. And the way that the system has been set up or structured in terms of the legislation is that it will afford people limited access. So it's not that you can tip everything out the bucket or out the pot. I know that that term isn't preferred here, but there are restraints that limit your ability to move everything out of the system. Having said that, if assets are taken out of your retirement fund, then the most effective application of those assets is going to be pay down debt, pay down a mortgage, pay down loans on other assets. My suspicion, given South Africa's predisposition or a bias towards consumption, my suspicion is these a disproportionate amount of the money that comes out of the system will be pointed towards consumption rather than looking after the balance sheet. And to me, that's that's as worrying as the compounding that's taken away. And it's going to feed more consumption in South Africa rather than saving an investment. And saving an investment is the critical ingredient that's missing from South Africa's growth structure.
And 10, maybe 20 years down the line, that would indicate more individual financial pain for people, which also leads me to ask the question then, is this entire concept irresponsible?
You know, we really are on the horns of a dilemma, Jeremy, because on the one hand, you've got consumers, households who have been stranded. The economy has been growthless for a decade or more. Unemployment rates are elevated. Inequality is entrenched. You've got fatigued, beleaguered consumers and households. It doesn't look like interest rates are going to get cut anytime soon. That adds to the strain of households, so on and so forth. So, you know, that's the one horn of the dilemma. How do you provide relief? The most responsible thing to do would be to make sure that the structural reforms that the South African economy so desperately needs are put in place to achieve growth and address unemployment. That would be the single most responsible thing to do. Instead, this has all of the feel of Band-Aid. Let's find a way, you know, to throw a lifeline in the absence of that growth and structural reform. And that's the horns of the dilemma that we sit on, unfortunately.
So have you applied your mind then to other ways of short-term financial relief?
Well, in terms of that short-term financial relief, we know that the South African banking system is a place that, you know, through reform would be able to afford consumers or borrowers, you know, a significantly better outcome. In part, this is because of unsecured lending. In other places, it's because of loans that are, and especially long-term loans, that have not been competitively priced. And you've seen that by one of the banks recently announcing that, you know, there is mispricing in terms of long-term loans. That type of competitive edge would be a way in which the system would look after South African households, South African balance sheets, without compromising the long-term fortune. In fact, you know, that's what I would refer to as a win-win outcome.
I'm going to leave it there. Adrian Saville, as always, thank you very much indeed for that crisp analysis. And that conversation also informing our poll today, the two-pot retirement system. What's your view? Can't wait? Do you think it's risky? Or are you going to stay as you are? If you have a view on that, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or our LinkedIn page. On our online poll yesterday, we spoke about South Africa's kidnapping crisis. I asked you if you were worried, if you were taking precautions, or if you have kidnap insurance. Over 80% of our respondents say we do have a crisis in this respect, and less than 2% of our audience actually have insurance. MoneyWeb at midday. We're live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.